Welcome to Site Selection Matters, where we take a close look at the art and science of site selection decision-making. I'm your host, Rick Weddle, president of the Site Selectors Guild. In each episode, we introduce you to leaders in the world of corporate site selection and economic development. We speak with members of the Site Selectors Guild, our economic development partners, and corporate decision makers to provide you with deep insight into the best and next practices in our profession. In this episode, we have as our guest, Renee Buck, CEO of BCI Global, one of the world's leading independent footprint optimization, location strategy, site selection, and supply chain consulting companies. BCI has offices in the U.S., in Europe, and in Asia. Today, Renee will talk with us about increasing chances for reshoring of production from Asia to the U.S. More specifically, we'll also talk with Renee about what's driving this movement and the U.S. states that are the best positioned to capture future reshoring investments. Join me as we welcome Renee Buck to Site Selection Matters. Renee, before we get into a deep dive on this important topic, take a minute, if you will, to explain to our listeners what you mean by decentralization of production, or also called reshoring, and maybe also a little bit about what the current drivers are of this process.
Yeah, sure. We hear a lot about reshoring, and reshoring is like something which went out of the U.S. or out of Europe to China / Asia and is now supposed to come back. Let's say we prefer, and I mean with we also, our corporate clients prefer the wording decentralization of manufacturing. And decentralization of manufacturing means that it's the opposite of having all your eggs in one basket. You can imagine that you have a certain product or a certain product line. And you say, well, there's only one place on earth where I produce that. So it's a global manufacturing plant. Then you will have regional manufacturing plants saying, okay, well, this product, I produce it in a plant in for Asia-Pac. I have a plant for North America, and I have a plant for Europe. And decentralization means even having more plants than just opposite to having one global plant. So we came for economies of scale reasons. A number of companies chose the last decades to say, well, I have one global plant who produces that product. But on the one hand, the U.S.-China trade disputes, and on the other hand, COVID-19 have made clear that that can be a risky and bumpy road. So what we see is that companies are looking now into, hey, should we not decentralize our manufacturing? So not having this product produced only in one or two plants, but the more closer to the market so that we are not that vulnerable for business disruption risk. And the reasons, the drivers behind that, are there are a couple of drivers. One is from a supply chain risk perspective. You know, you want to reduce the sourcing risk. You want to reduce the risk that you are too dependent of critical suppliers in only one single region. And let's be honest, COVID-19, certainly in February and March and April, made clear that supply chains all over the world were disturbed by the fact that the critical suppliers in China could not deliver anymore. So you have supply chain drivers in terms of mitigating sourcing risk. We have also external disruption risk. We talk about pandemic. We talk about trade barrier risk. Let's not forget that for a lot of American companies, this decentralization challenge, where should we produce what products with what technologies for what markets where? So I repeat, what products do we produce with what technologies for what markets where? That's a question which for many companies, U.S.-based companies, already from early 2016, when the current administration took office in the White House, and where the China-U.S. trade dispute challenged a lot of companies by saying, okay, should we have all eggs in one Chinese basket? So we have supply chain risks where decentralization can be a solution. We have external disruption risk, like pandemics and earthquakes and natural disasters and trade barrier risk. And we have also a third category is more strategic customer benefits. You know, there are clients more and more who like the fact that product is made in the US or made in Europe or made in Germany. So for these three drivers, supply chain drivers, external disruption risk mitigation measures, and taking advantage of strategic customer benefits. Those are the three main drivers why companies are considering decentralization. And that looks all logical from these three perspectives. But on the other hand, we see that companies say, okay, but, you know, if we compare the production costs in China with Germany or Massachusetts, there is a huge difference. Is the supply base in countries where you would like to decentralize, to be closer to main markets in the US and in Europe, is the supplier base there so available that you can match that with what you can find in Asia? And let's not forget, for a lot of companies, China and Asia are still very important markets. So there are drivers for this thought process at the C-level with a lot of companies in decentralization of manufacturing from a supply chain perspective, from a customer benefit perspective, and from a risk mitigation perspective. But it's not a late Friday afternoon decision, because for many companies, it's also a complex decision process they have to go through to find out what is really the optimal footprint for us.
Rene, in listening to you talk about that, those three drivers, let me follow up on that. One of the things that I'm hearing in a lot of our conversations is, in the U.S., we've talked about essential workers during this COVID-19 that have to go back to work. But we've also haven't talked so much about, but we hear about essential industries. And the U.S. government is actually now talking about essential industries. For example, one that you wouldn't think about, soaps and sanitizers, as an example, not your typical target industry. But we're hearing that the federal government's requiring a certain amount of that now to be produced onshore. So I guess that would factor, those kinds of strategic questions would factor into the company's decision also.
Oh, I completely agree. Let's say if you talk about PPE equipment, medical instruments, I think also, let's say various governments, Japan, the US, are trying to facilitate that process for onshoring by having them close by. There are two ways to do that. One is just having more inventory. You know, there are a lot of companies who were proud that they had only inventory of 4 or 5 weeks. And then if something in your supply chain goes wrong, then you are running out of products very soon. The other is producing that onshore. But let me give you an example, Rick, on ventilators, you know, being used in intensive care unit. A ventilator has about 500 components. I relocate the final assembly of a ventilator from China, from Asia, to the US. Okay, in that final assembly operation, I produce 200 of the 500 components. Now, the other 300 are still coming from all over the place. So the question here is, how much have you de-risked by putting your final assembly operation in the US? Now, on the pharma side, that's different, because the basic ingredients for pharmaceutical products, API, are for 80% produced in India and China, which makes us vulnerable for urgent products. So I see that push of the government, but I'm more from the side that I think also our clients, our corporate clients, should decide on sound business cases where you tailor in, where you incorporate that strategic advantage or disadvantage for not or yes being onshore.
Rene, before COVID-19, if we were having this conversation, much of our talk would have been probably about cost reduction, lower structural cost, all of those rationalizing cost operations, like in a location like China, whatever. Since the lockdown with the pandemic, though, a lot of the talk, just as we've had the discussion this morning, has shifted to risk and resilience. And those are words that we hear more and more as a heavier weight in the decision framework. In fact, you talk about the need for a resilience framework. What do you mean by that?
A lot of companies have experienced during COVID-19 that A, they were very dependent on a couple of suppliers, B, that a lot of these suppliers were in China, and as we all know, the pandemic started in China, and C was also that a lot of these companies found out that they didn't know how their total supply chain was built up. You know, you have your tier one suppliers, but also the suppliers of the suppliers, or the suppliers of the suppliers of your suppliers. So having that chain visible was for many companies a difficulty, and they experience that right now. Now, let's say risk and cost are still related with each other. If there's a cost differential between the US and China for a certain product, say that's every year $20 million, okay. If you want to mitigate that risk and you have to spend in 5 years' time, five multiplied with 20 is $100 million extra, I don't know whether your CFO will look that optimistic and have a smile on his face if you say, well, I have a resilient, a future-proof solution by producing onshore, but it's far more expensive. So you have to look what are various ways. There are ways for dual sourcing. So making not depending on one critical supplier, but on more geographically spread. You can look into certain decentralization, not of all your product lines, but at least that you can produce backup or necessary products in the American market itself. And there is a price on the pandemic. You know, if you have a lockdown in China, and let's be honest, the lockdown is also in other parts of the world, because a lot of Chinese companies were complaining in May that they didn't get their German suppliers providing them the products in Shanghai and in Beijing. So reshoring and that process of resilience is also has a geographical focus. But coming back to your question, you can build resilience by building up inventory stock, by dual sourcing, by reshoring parts of your production. And then still there is in many cases a cost to that. And you just have to make the trade-off between, hey, this is cheaper. But on the other hand, if we add to the cost differential, the costs for lockdown, you know, if you are 2 months closed and you have to pay your employees and all the costs are running up, that's a substantial loss. And I would say in certain products, particularly in the US, the trade measures where you have a 25% import duty on certain products, help to build the business case for the US. Now, you have to be cautious with that because nobody knows whether we will have trade tariffs also in 2 or 5 years' time. My belief, my personal belief, Rick, is it will, because the US-China trade dispute is not a trade war. It's not about soybeans bought by Chinese in the Midwest. It's about a technology war. It's about economic leadership in the world. It's about the number one and two economies in the world fighting for technology leadership. So I think that trade tariffs will stay for another 10 years, actually. And that means that can help. It's coming from a different angle, but that trade tariffs can help you in building a reshoring business case if that's logical for a company. And again, it's depending on the type of products, the investments you have to make, the supplier base, whether they are available in the US in comparison with China, Malaysia, Vietnam, or India. But that's the equation we have to do. And a lot of our clients, we as you know, we have teams in Singapore and Shanghai and in the US. And a lot of our teams are now working on making for companies scenarios. Hey, if we would relocate one product line or two or three or four, and how would that influence the manufacturing footprint and how would it reduce the risk? So how can we de-risk the supply chain? And there is no way that you completely can exclude risks, delivery risk, but you can find measures like dual sourcing, more inventory, and a decentralization of manufacturing capacity, at least that you mitigate the risk, that you make the risk smaller. It will never be a risk-free world, and that's why we are all entrepreneurs.
Renee, I'm intrigued. Your comment earlier in your comment on that, you use the term future-proof your manufacturing footprint. I'm intrigued by that. I mean, obviously, in a world that's as uncertain, unsteady, unstable as we are right now, future-proofing would be a wonderful thing if we could do that. Is this really possible? And how would it go? How does a firm go about approaching future-proofing?
Future-proofing in our way, and the method we use for that, Rick, is really scenario planning. So you have a scenario where you say, okay, I have, and I take a simple example. I have one product, I make audio speakers, and I make them in one plant in China. Now, low production costs, economies of scale, but on the other hand, risk, because if it's a part of input duties, and if there is something going wrong in that one plant or in the insourcing, the inbound products for the assembly of those speakers, you have a problem. You can make 20 plans in the world for making those producers, and you're sure that you are more expensive. So future-proofing means that you reduce the risks which you know that can exist. If we know now that a pandemic can take 8 weeks, suppose that you are 8 weeks out of business. Now, if you normally have 4 weeks of inventory of a certain component or sub-assembly, you could say, well, I increase that to 8 weeks. Then I have de-risked to a certain extent my supply chain. Now, obviously, that's costing money because I have warehouses with components and sub-assemblies which I don't use. So that's expensive. But it's a way to circumvent, to reduce the risk. Future-proofing means that you look into the risk, find ways to circumvent and to reduce and to mitigate those risks, and look what for the company is the best trade-off between production cost, quality of the business environment, customer expectations, and risks which can really put your business in jeopardy. So it's always a trade-off between the various. There is no, if you would have a complete risk-free solution, it would probably be so expensive that a company would go bankrupt before the end of the day.
Very interesting, Rene. You make it's very commonsensical and very strategic with scenario planning. You make it sound simple, and I'm assuming that we're going to have more and more people, more and more companies looking at that in the years ahead. Recently, BCI Global completed a study showing how U.S. states rank for manufacturing competitiveness and how the opportunity to benefit directly from reshoring efforts might occur. Which states does your work show are best positioned to benefit from this accelerated or increased reshoring or decentralization process?
So the start of our analysis was, we see with among our clients that decentralization of production / reshoring is on their agenda. Now, we know that it's heavily depending on what the plant, and we take an example in China, what the plant is producing, where the sourcing is coming from, so their components, sub-assemblies, intermediate products, and where it's going to. Because you can easily imagine that if you have a plant in China as an American company which produces for 80% or 90% for the Chinese market, you don't put that plant in the U.S., right? So you have to look to certain products. You have to look to the specific profile of sourcing and final distribution. You have to look whether those products play a role in the trade tariff discussion between various trade partners in the world. And so we took an example of a company producing electronic components and said, okay, if you have a plant and it has 250 people on board, and how would that the various states in the U.S. rank? So it's really, that makes our work so interesting, Rick. It's really case by case. In this case, the analysis showed that if we take cost into account, so all the cost factors, if I compare Shenzhen with Illinois or Shenzhen with Georgia or Shenzhen with whatever state in the U.S., that if you take all cost factors into account, all quality of the business environment factors into account and risk environment, that for this company producing liquid crystal devices with those 250, with that given sourcing and distribution pattern, 8 states, let's say, were in the top league: Georgia, Florida, Utah, Mississippi, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Nebraska, and Michigan. But I underline that this is for this particular plant. So there are a lot of states in the U.S. and counties and metros and cities who all say, also politically driven and obviously to mitigate the unemployment levels they have right now, in saying, yeah, we need more plants who reshore. But you have really to look into, what can we offer? Do we have the supplier system, which this company is looking for? Think about my example on these ventilators in the intensive care units. So it's a case by case. And also that means that EDOs from the very active EDOs in the U.S. who want to be in this area really have to think, what are the sectors of industry or the type of operations in Asia where we think that based on our cost profile, our quality of the business environment profile, and our risk profile, where we really have a good chance for making a business case to the company that they will consider us as a suitable candidate if that company decides to reshore some of their production capacity to the U.S.
Makes all the sense in the world. And so the EDO ought to look at it from the same way that the companies look at it and the same way that you advise them to look at it in terms of what's the business case and how does that fit into the corporate strategy of what's going on.
100% correct. Because, yeah. You know, I understand the push why EDOs want to have new manufacturing plants, certainly in these difficult economic times. But at the end of the day, there should be a realistic business case. And a realistic business case might be that you say, well, you know, it's a couple of million dollars per year cheaper in Thailand, but I still want, for strategic reasons or for customer satisfaction reason, this plant still in the US. That's good. But it starts with calculating what are the differences. In our models, we include the lockdown costs. So you make assumptions of what would that mean in terms of transportation, in terms of interim management, in terms of loss of sales, etc. So by making these kind of scenarios, and you mentioned a minute ago, that sounds easy, but I try to make it easy, but it's, in reality, it's quite complex modeling. Together with the client, we try to find out what is really the best solution here. And that way of thinking is typically what, let's say, what I think that EDU should adopt. So every time I'm in an event of the Site Selectors Guild, I try to translate the majority of our businesses working for corporates. And how can the corporate thinking help EDOs to achieve their objectives?
Good idea. Renee, let's take a longer term look now. We've been in the weeds looking at a lot of details over this process. But if you had a crystal ball to peer into now, what do you see happening over the next few years? And also, what could a U.S. state or a community do to improve their positioning in that time frame?
I think if you look to the drivers, the drivers for companies are circumstances which you cannot influence. So companies are used to the fact that they have a great product and it sells like hell and you need more production line. Companies are used to the fact that you have that your competitor makes a better product and sells more, and that you have you see decreasing revenues of that certain product. But what companies have difficulty with is coping with external business disruption risk. We talked about natural disasters. Now, a pandemic is a global one, and hopefully not every year, but we have earthquakes before, we had tsunamis, we have fires, we have flooding. So natural disaster risk is something you know as a company that you have to cope with it and that you have to address it while you don't have the means to immediately influence that. That's the same with trade disputes. A couple of years ago, CEOs of large companies read in a tweet of the president that their product has become all of a sudden 25% more expensive. So I think companies will get more used to the fact that you have to deal with circumstances you cannot influence. But your customers are still where they are. So your customers are still in the US and in Europe and perhaps in Asia. So I think that that decentralization trend will be for many companies a strategy to consider, because it just makes the supply chain less vulnerable for these external business disruption risks. So my idea is that more companies will choose for more regional manufacturing. So, and I say it simply, a plant in the US for North America, a plant in Poland for Europe, and a plant in Malaysia or China for the Asian market. And that decentralization trend is also enhanced by new modern manufacturing technology. Think about 3D printing, additive manufacturing. Think about smart manufacturing technologies. So we will see that also this decentralization trend will be enhanced by new manufacturing technologies, by additive manufacturing, 3D printing. So that will help companies to have more smaller plants around the world, which are still cost competitive. So those plants will be smaller than that one global hub plant, but will be closer to markets. And then still in the market, you can consider, you know, if you want to sell your products or produce your product in North America, you still have the chance to go to the US, but you can also go to Mexico or even other Latin countries. So that discussion will go on. So I think that manufacturing will be the new arena will be, if there are long-lasting external business disruption risks, You cannot say anymore as a CEO or as a VP corporate development or VP manufacturing or VP corporate real estate, we didn't know. The trade disputes between the US and China, the pandemics, the natural disasters we had globally, everybody knows you have to look into a footprint which on the one hand combines the economies of scale and the cost competitiveness you need, but you combine that with as much as possible de-risking of your total supply chain. And that's interesting work, that's fun work to work with, and that's what we do on a day-to-day basis.
Well, that's it in a nutshell, de-risking of your supply chain. Accomplish that, and you'll be in pretty good shape. Renee, you've given us a lot to think about in our short conversation today. What a great time we've had discussing this. But that's all the time we have today. So let me say thank you to Renee Buck with BCI Global for talking with us today on this episode of Site Selection Matters.
Thank you very much, Rick. It was my pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Site Selection Matters, and a special thanks today to Renee Buck for helping us get inside and better understand global supply chains, U.S. competitiveness, and what companies can do to future-proof their manufacturing footprint. What an informative discussion. Again, I'm Rick Weddle, president of the Site Selectors Guild. This podcast represents my views and the views of my guests, and they do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of the Site Selectors Guild or its membership. We hope you'll subscribe to Site Selection Matters podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you like what you hear on Site Selection Matters, you should check out the Guild's new four-part live webinar series starting September 29 through January of 2021. We're featuring a diverse group of Guild member panelists delving into hot industries like advanced manufacturing and logistics, and timely topics such as virtual site visits and diversity in site selection. Visit siteselectorsguild.com/webinars to learn more. We look forward to bringing you great content and commentary in the year ahead. Until next time, good day.